Mr. Coates. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the issue in this case is whether a public school district can regulate indecent speech in a public school setting that does not amount to obscene speech under this Court's Miller versus California standard. The facts in this case are that on April 26, 1983, Matt Frazier, a 17-year-old high school senior, gave a speech to the Associated Student Body. The speech was to not introduce his candidate for the vice principal or the vice president's position of the Associated Student Body. He gave a crude and vulgar speech. The speech is set forth in full in the briefs, and there's no purpose to repeat it here. It is important to note that Mr. Frazier did obtain a significant reaction to his speech, that some of the students hooted and hollered, some of the students looked bewildered, some looked embarrassed, some students even acted out certain physical acts symbolizing various sexual acts. After the speech, the school administration investigated the incident, provided Mr. Frazier with his due process rights, and suspended him for 3 days and struck him from the list of those candidates who would be considered to be a graduation speaker. Mr. Frazier appealed to the district court. The district court, as affirmed by the Ninth Circuit, has ruled that a public school district can only regulate student speech if it is obscene under the Miller versus California standard. Or the one exception they seemingly recognize is if the speech caused a physical disruption or there was a reasonable prediction of a physical disruption. Finally, the district court, as affirmed by the Ninth Circuit, struck down the district's disruptive conduct rule, holding it was overbroad and vague. It is well decided, and we agree, that students do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse door. However, it is equally well decided that those constitutional rights will be administered in a way that is sensitive to the school environment. We are here because the Ninth Circuit, we believe, has misconstrued the extent of the rights a student has under the First Amendment in the public school setting. They failed to recognize the special relationship between students and their teachers. And finally, they failed to recognize the secondary effects such conduct has in the public school setting. In beginning our analysis of the First Amendment, it is useful to compare this case with this Court's decision in Tinker versus Des Moines School District. In Tinker, the facts were that students wore black armbands into the public schools in protest of the Vietnam War. There was nothing intrinsically harmful about the black armbands. What the school officials were concerned about was that the black armbands stood for protest against this government's position in Vietnam. Tinker was a viewpoint discrimination case where the school officials determined that that viewpoint on an important public policy issue should not be interjected in a school system. Contrasting that case with this fact pattern, it is noteworthy that Mr. Frazier, at testimony, was asked, "What was the purpose of your speech?" He responded quite candidly, I gave the speech to humor the citizen, to humor my audience in the hopes they would vote for my candidate. There's no overriding public policy.
Did his candidate win?
His candidate did win.
Yes,
he did.
How many students are there involved here?
Approximately 600, Justice Marshall, in the school setting.
What was the grade or age range of the students?
It's a school that had sophomores through seniors, so the youngest would be 14, the oldest would be 18, and they would range in there according to their grades. Mr. Frazier, you'll note that the district did not take cavalierly his claims that he was being discriminated against or that somehow his viewpoint was being suppressed. That if you review the record in this case, you'll find that Mr. Frazier appealed to the district's hearing officer from the decision of his building principal. And I think if you read that decision, which is part of the joint appendix, that one of the conclusions that was not overturned by the district court was that there was no viewpoint discrimination here, that the district's sole concern was to limit vulgarity and indecent language in the school setting. This court has been very clear and has oft repeated that it does not want to get involved in the daily operation of the school system, that it only wants to get involved when core constitutional values are involved and sharply implicated. This Court has also indicated that the regulation of vulgarity and indecent speech is on the periphery of the First Amendment. We submit to this Court that when you review this case, one of the issues is where does the federal court system relate itself to the public schools. And we would suggest to you, with the rights herein involved and the speech here involved, absent viewpoint suppression, that there should be minimal court review and that all the school district should be required to do is to justify its action with a reasonable education purpose.
Mr. Coates, may I ask you a question? This is an extracurricular assembly, is it? It's not part of the regular — students were not required to attend, is that right?
Well, I want to be very clear on what the context is, because I think that's important. It was — students had the option of either going to the assembly or going to a study hall. Now, the ASB, however, in the state of Washington, is an activity that is statutorily recognized and required. And those statutes, which are RCW 28A, 58, 115 through 120, I think you'll find that they're somewhat uniquely specific in this area compared to other states that I've seen. And they make very clear that this activity is under the direction and control of the public school setting. So this is no more an elective activity than, for example, when a student elects to take drama rather than going to a study hall. This is part of the educational program of this particular school district, as it is in other school districts.
In your view, would it be permissible, given that setting, for the school board to prohibit the discussion of any religious topics during any campaign speech or any prayer activities? Let's all say a prayer for candidate X.
Clearly. This is not the case of Bender versus Williamsport.
Well, that's really my question.
And I think it's important to note that Bender involved independent student activities. This activity is supported by public funds. It's under the direction and control and supervision of the school authorities. The school officials lead the activity. We assign advisors to it. We subsidize it with public funds.
I understand. But what is your answer to my question?
Well, the answer is it's not the same case at all as Bender.
What is your answer to my question? Whether, in your view, the school board could prohibit during this particular kind of meeting any discussion of religious topics or any prayer activities in support of a candidate?
The answer to your question is yes.
You think they could?
I would think they would be compelled to. This is something that occurs during a student day when students are required to either be there in a study hall. And I think it would clearly further that religious activity under the Establishment Clause.
Mr. Coates, would it make any difference in your view if the school had tried to discipline the student for activities occurring at lunchtime or on the school premises after school?
I think in the school setting there could be enclaves of privacy, and I think that it's important that this case comes up under the disruptive conduct rule of the district, and that one of the things that the district has found in its disruptive conduct rule is that obscene and profane speech is inherently harmful in the school setting. Now, we would say that if somebody is, for example, swearing around others in the school setting, that would be a concern to us, and we could discipline the student for that. They're under the control of the school. We are responsible.
Do you think that the school could, for instance, prohibit the use of so-called four-letter words at any and all times the students are on school grounds? Before, after, during?
As long as it was a school activity. There are certain private activities that involve students that rent school space. But as long as it is a school activity, my answer would be yes. I think the school and the board, through its rulemaking authority, has determined that's inherently harmful to the school climate. And as long as there is a school activity, my answer to your question would be yes.
Well, is lunchtime a school activity when the students break for lunch?
They're under the control, and I think that the school has a definite educational interest in maintaining an environment around the school premises free from vulgarities. Students essentially are required to be there. It's a captive audience of school children.
You think the school could implement its discipline in this case had there been no school regulation at all on the subject?
Clearly, I think procedural due process requires us to have regulations in effect. And actually, under the Washington Administrative Code requires that, as my understanding, your decisions in Goss versus Lopez. So, yes, we have to have pre-existing rules. You know, in this case, we did have a rule, and the student was charged in that rule.
We have to decide in this case whether the rule was sufficiently specific to give notice to Mr. Frazier of what was prohibited?
Yeah, the Ninth Circuit has struck down the rule, claiming it was overbroad and vague. Their overbreadth argument depends upon their determination that our discipline and our disciplining a student for use of obscene and profane language is in excess of our authority. The vagueness argument is a due process argument that says our rule is excessively vague, and that is an issue that is before the court. I do think it is important in looking at the educational interests to keep in mind that there are really twofold educational interests. One of those interests relates more to the educational nature of this particular activity, that one of the requirements, and something this Court has oft recognized, is that schools teach societal values. Indeed, there's a statute in the state of Washington that expressly makes it a duty of the school district to teach morality, self-respect for others, and civility. The purpose of this ASB activity is multifold, but certainly one of them is to teach these students basic societal values. Another object of this activity, particularly this assembly, is to teach students the art of public discourse. Now, in this educational activity, there is a special relationship between the students and their instructors. Indeed, the school officials feel they would have been remiss if they'd not corrected Mr. Frazier. His speech was inappropriate. It was a bad speech. They, as educators, had a duty to correct it. But they not only had a duty to Mr. Frazier, but they also had a duty to the other students who were present. I think when you look at this fact pattern here, you have a senior student, a student who had received honors, who was a gifted orator, and he gives a speech such as that contained in the record. The impression that other students get at that assembly is that that speech is appropriate in that particular context. The school district sitting in
a... Matter of fact, wasn't that speech given to a teacher the day before?
Okay. The record on that, it was given, he claims, to three teachers. Two teachers testified. Approximately 10 minutes in advance of the assembly, Mr. Frazier went in, and the teacher was the teacher that had the responsibility for the newspaper. Other students were present. And that teacher told Mr. Frazier, she said, Matt, and this is her testimony, that speech is inappropriate. Don't give it. He then went to another teacher, Mr. DeHart. Mr. DeHart told him, and his testimony will show, Matt, that speech is inappropriate. Don't give it. Mr. Hart also testified that it was his recollection that he intimated there would be severe consequences if he did. That is the record.
But he wasn't told by the principal.
Well, the principal didn't know he was going to give the speech. The two teachers who reviewed it told him it was inappropriate not to give it.
Did the teachers have authority to stop him from making the speech?
I think the teachers exercised their
authority. I'm asking, did they or did they not have the authority to stop him from making the speech?
They would have authority, for example, to demand that he go to the office. But I would submit to you that that's really not how discipline works. It's not a realistic view that if a teacher in a school setting tells a student that's inappropriate, don't do it, and then the student doesn't respond, then it becomes appropriate for disciplinary action.
Well, it seems to me that if the teacher teaching chemistry tells the child don't go to dance class, that wouldn't be enforceable. That's why I was asking what authority did it. Was this his teacher? Was this his homeroom teacher?
I think that there is...
It's just a teacher.
Yeah, a significant question of prior restraint. And if the teacher, could ask and go, I would think that we would be premature there and that we did not have a proper basis for disciplinary action until after he gave the speech.
What I'm getting at, I'm not trying to be mysterious about it. If the school had a possibility, had noticed, and an opportunity to stop the speech, it would be a different case, wouldn't it?
Yes, that is not the facts here.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay, excuse me, I misconstrued your question. That the records as I recited it, but the school district did have a duty to these other students to impress upon them that in this educational activity, this type of speech wasn't appropriate in any way whatsoever. And I think it's important to note that this district acted with restraint. Again, if you read the record from the school district, one of the findings of the hearing officer who considered this was that a lesser form of corrective action would not have corrected this particular problem. Indeed, the school district feels strongly that in its capacity as an educator in dealing with these students, it has had an obligation to respond to this particular speech. Mr. Frazier seems to argue that the school district's sole remedy is to talk it over with him, to debate with him the appropriateness of this. We submit to this court that Mr. Frazier's argument misconstrues the relationship of a student to an educator. It's not a relationship of one debater to another, that indeed the educator has authority over the student when properly exercised. Finally, we submit to you that the real question is if the school district could regulate this speech. This court held as recently as last week in the Public Utilities Commission case out of California that the First Amendment does not dictate that you respond or more speech. Or as we would phrase it, the First Amendment may restrict a school district's ability to censor various views in the public school system. But once they are able to regulate an area such as vulgarity and indecency, the First Amendment does not dictate how they must go about that. We also note that there are important secondary effects in this case. We think it's important that this came up under the school district's disruptive conduct rule. And when you read that rule, clearly a school district has a right to prescribe disruptive conduct in the school setting. And this board of directors, in advance, gave notice and concluded that obscene and profane speech was inherently harmful and disruptive to the public school setting. Essentially, what the Ninth Circuit has held is that a public school district cannot reach that conclusion and cannot have such a rule. We submit to you that the board's determination that vulgarity and indecency was inherently harmful in the public school setting is supported by rational basis. First of all, the school has a duty to protect the young adults who are there and essentially a captive audience. Secondly, such conduct is inherently demeaning to the school setting. This is where we require in the state of Washington students to come to learn. This court has recognized in cases such as PICO, where the plurality spoke, and where it expressed its concern in that opinion, that the district did not have the authority to suppress ideas in the school setting. But it had no problem, it said, if there had been a facially neutral rule designed to prohibit indecent language in the public school setting.
Mr. Coates, may I just ask on the rule? The rule prohibits material and substantial interference with the educational process, including obscene and profane language. Now, what is your position, that this was obscene language within the meaning of the rule?
Yes. You'll find that that was considered again by the hearing officer's decision at the school district. And the school district's interpretation of its own rule is that obscene should be given its common and ordinary meaning, which includes lewd and vulgar language.
But of course, we're dealing by hypothesis with speech that's non-obscene for constitutional purposes.
The speech does not meet the standard of Miller versus California. We can see that it's not close. But I would point out to you that the standard that was set out in Miller versus California on obscenity, according to this court, was designed only to prescribe hardcore pornography. And this court has recognized that there are some lesser standards which may apply in particular situations, such as in FCC versus Pacifica, the mini theaters case out of Detroit. And we're suggesting that a lesser standard is appropriate in a public school setting. Now, the standard that we propose essentially is that first you look at the constitutional right we're enforcing, and that when there is a suppression of ideas and or a discrimination against ideas, that the school district have to show with a higher standard or show with some compelling interest its reason for suppressing those ideas. But here, where the record clearly shows that the only purpose for the school's action was to suppress vulgarity and indecency in the public school setting, then we would suggest to the court that the school district should only have to meet a standard of showing a rational educational basis. And clearly there's such a basis.
May I just add this question about it? I understand that the board construed the word obscene in this case to cover this speech. Is there any prior history of indicating that within the school own proceedings of any kind that the word obscene as used in the rule was intended to be as broad as it's interpreted in this case?
Were there prior cases?
Anything that would fairly, the question is the same thing, I think maybe Justice O'Connor would drive it. The fair notice to the student as to whether this speech was covered by this word.
I think my response to you was that have no written decisions in construing this, and that to my knowledge, this was the first time that the district had construed its own rule where there was a record kept. Now, school rules are enforced on a daily basis in the public school setting, and I can assure you that if a student swears or is vulgar in the school setting, whether it's in a classroom, in the hall, or in an assembly, school officials have taken corrective action. But we do, most of the time, we don't get an appeal from that. Here, there was also, as shown in the record, there was a prior case from the year before where a student used, actually an ASB assembly, used inappropriate speech. And indeed, the district called the student into the office, and in fact, the principal talked to him in what we would consider discipline. Told him that, you know, that better be stopped or he's going to be in trouble. Now, Mr. Fraser construes that. He says, well, he knew that speech was given, and he thought that the only thing happened was the principal called him in and talked to him about it. Big deal. I mean, he gives probably the best evidence we have of why the district in this case was compelled to take a more demonstrative action to impress upon the students that this was not appropriate speech in that particular form in that public setting. If possible, I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Mr. Haley.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I will begin my rebuttal, my response, with some response to positions taken by my opposing counsel. And I will begin with what was the most important error by opposing counsel in characterizing the record. He said that that two teachers told Matt Fraser, "Don't give it," is what he said. I will quote from the record. "I told Matt that his speech was inappropriate and that he probably should not deliver it." That was the first teacher who was most critical of the speech, Mrs. Hicks. That's at page 30 of the Joint Appendix. The second teacher, I'm quoting, "My response at that time was that I told Matt that this would indeed cause problems and that it would raise eyebrows." That was the extent of his warning not to give the speech. None of them suggested that it might violate a school rule. In fact, the first teacher, who was most critical of it, said in her testimony afterwards at the trial, "I wasn't aware that there was a school rule regarding that." In this case, if the teachers don't have any idea that such a speech might violate a school rule, when they are charged with enforcement of the school rule as among their duties as teachers, the rule is clearly so vague and so lacking of adequate notice, at least when it comes to First Amendment rights, freedom of speech, that we cannot punish a student who gave a speech after previewing it with three teachers.
Does the school have a written rule that one shall not swear in Latin class?
The written rule is the same rule that we're talking about here.
I know. I'm asking you, yes or no?
Yes, it does.
That one shall not swear in Latin class.
The rule does not say one shall not swear in Latin class. The rule says that obscene or profane language will be considered disruptive. Certainly, the disruptive conduct exception articulated by Tinker can reach the content of speech, can reach speech which, due solely to its content, is disruptive. And I suggest in Latin class, profanity would distract students from the lessons at hand, would show disrespect to the teacher, and would disrupt the order of the class, and would be disruptive of the educational process. Well, we must distinguish carefully between profanity or dirty words, which are relatively easily identified, and which have very few purposes that are other than to insult or to create a negative emotional reaction or to vent a negative emotional reaction. And sexual metaphor, which especially in this case, did not have any such purpose to insult or to vent an emotional reaction or to create a negative emotional reaction.
Suppose there were a school rule that explicitly said that speech that stimulated simulated sexual conduct would be disciplined, and then suppose this speech had been given. Also, assume the rule was posted on the bulletin board of every school, every room in the schoolhouse.
A rule which prohibited speech describing sexual conduct?
That stimulated simulating sexual conduct.
Well,
what I'm interested in is whether, if adequate notice were given, so that no one could have misconstrued it, that this sort of speech would result in punishment. What would your response be?
I think it's very difficult for students, or for that matter, for anyone, to anticipate how other juvenile students will respond to any particular speech.
So you're saying the notice really doesn't matter?
I'm saying that a rule which prohibits speech that might stimulate a response by someone else, which has a sexual character, would be a rule that would be far too vague and too overbroad to withstand First Amendment scrutiny.
Can you conceive of any rule that would not be too vague?
Well, certainly a rule which prohibits obscene speech. And obscene speech...
You mean obscene in the Miller sense, our decision in Miller?
No, I think counsel is misconstruing the opinions of this court when they suggest that Miller is the test that must be met for obscenity in the high schools. Ginsburg suggests that obscenity is a much lower standard, a much easier standard to meet for children. Hmm. And this speech might well have been obscene for elementary schools or for junior high schools under the proper Miller and Ginsburg test. I don't think they need a full Miller test in the high schools.
Mm-hmm. How would you limit the use of obscene in this particular rule, then?
How would I limit the use of obscene?
Yes. That word was in the rule.
That word was in the rule. In the case of FCC versus Pacifica, there was that rule prohibited indecent speech.
Yes.
This rule does not prohibit indecent speech. It only prohibits obscene, profane language or gestures. When it refers to language, it's clearly talking about words, as in the result in the FCC case. It's talking about dirty words.
If it had prohibited indecent speech, would your position be different?
With respect to vagueness of the rule, it certainly would.
Mr. Harris, supposing that the rule had simply prohibited this particular speech in hyc verba, so that there could be no question that the person who was about to deliver the speech knew that it was prohibited by the rule, do you think that rule is bad under the First Amendment?
The issue before us, we have two issues before us.
Could you answer the question?
One, whether the rule could survive scrutiny under vagueness and overbreadth. And two, whether this speech would be protected no matter what rule was promulgated by the school before it was presented.
I asked you a question.
If this speech cannot be protected, then certainly that rule would be sufficient to punish Mr. Fraser in this case.
And that is your answer, that a rule that prohibited this speech in so many words would be constitutional?
If this speech can be prohibited under the First Amendment...
Well, can you give me a non-hypothetical answer to my question?
Well, a rule which prohibits speech that's protected by the Constitution is not a valid rule.
I agree with you.
This court has yet to decide whether this speech, although it's been decided by two courts below, is protected by the Constitution.
But what's your position?
I mean, my position is this speech is, in fact, protected by the Constitution.
So that no matter how specific the rule in giving notice, it would be bad under the First Amendment.
That's correct.
That the students were confused, or that this student was confused by the use of the word indecent or obscene instead of indecent?
In fact, this student was not given the handbook until after he was disciplined in this case. And so I'm not suggesting that he actually read the rule and was confused, but this is the rule that had guided the school for all the years that he had been at the school, and it had not been applied to speeches which used no profanity, were not in any way disruptive of a class or any curricular activity, or for that matter, any extracurricular activity. And there were speeches that had been given at the same nominating assembly 1 year earlier, which contained a four-letter word and contained a sexual reference. That student was not suspended from school. He was simply lectured in what I suggest is an appropriate fashion under the First Amendment.
Mr. Haley, what if the student here had, instead of the sexual innuendo in the talk, incorporated instead a string of profane words? Would that have survived First Amendment analysis?
Well, I think the proper standard for profane words in the high schools is the Tinker standard. And profane words might, in most cases, almost all cases, be disruptive of the educational process. They would, when they're used from one student
to
another,
suppose there was the same amount of disruption we had in this case. But instead of sexual innuendo, it was a string of profane words.
Whether each particular speech is protected by the Constitution depends upon the context of that speech. I can easily imagine that his use of profanity might have created antagonism between students, as a racial slur or religious epithet might have.
Assuming the same amount of disruption that we have here, would my example create a problem under the First Amendment?
If the school had a rule which prohibited the use of dirty words...
Same rule that we have here. We don't have a notice question. I'm interested in the First Amendment aspect.
It's a difficult question for him, but I think that it could be prohibited and the punishment would be appropriate.
I'm not sure that I know the basis for the distinction, then, in your view, for First Amendment analysis.
The basis is twofold for distinguishing between the use of profanity or dirty words and mere sexual allusion or imagery. First of all, we know what dirty words are. We know what profanity is. It's a much clearer line and a much easier standard to apply both for administrators within the schools and for courts developing principled decisions under it. Second of all, there are very few uses for profanity in the school context, which did not tend to create antagonism between students or tend to create disrespect between students and teachers or tend to have divisive, disruptive effects within the school situation. There are so few uses that the school might constitutionally adopt a rule which said its use is entirely prohibited. I suggest that a better rule would say its use in public is prohibited and that between consenting students on the school grounds, they might use such profanity. But any time it's used in public, it is so inherently likely to disrupt that we're going to rule it out in all cases. I think that would be constitutional.
In the last analysis, though, isn't it a regulation of the manner of speech as opposed to viewpoint suppression?
Well, I do not see this rule as applied in this case as a time, place, and manner restriction. I see it very much as a content restriction. That does not mean that it is impermissible in the schools, because certainly schools can regulate the content of speech under the Tinker standard, disruption. But in this case, this particular speech was not disruptive. The sexual metaphor that was used in this speech was not in any way intended to insult or create divisiveness between students or cause any disruption, and the record shows that there was no disruption. First of all, when Matt Fraser was accused of violating a school rule, no one mentioned that they thought he disrupted the educational process. They presented five letters to him, which characterized the speech as inappropriate, obscene, profane, etc. And those letters did not mention that they thought that there had been any disruption. It wasn't until the attorneys for the school district got involved with this case that the justification on the basis of disruption was advanced.
Tell me that if I find that it was any one of those three words, I have to rule against you.
That if it was profane or obscene?
And you had a third one.
Or indecent?
Yeah.
Well, the rule does not prohibit indecent speech. My Webster's Seventh Collegiate Dictionary does not define the word obscene to include indecent. The dictionary which they cite includes offensive to modesty. And I submit that any speech which is offensive to modesty cannot be prohibited within the schools.
Well, a stupid speech might be offensive. A stupid speech might be offensive.
It might indeed. Stupid speeches, and for that matter, humorous speeches, are protected by the Constitution.
Well, wouldn't you find this speech offensive to intelligent people?
No, personally, I don't find it offensive. The record suggests that most of the students were quite entertained by the speech, that it did succeed in establishing a rapport with the students, and that they succeeded in getting the candidate elected. Mm. Sex is not a forbidden topic for students. It's not an unknown
topic. That speech got him elected?
His candidate.
Do you think that speech got that candidate elected?
The candidate might have been elected.
Do you really want to blame that on 600 people?
Say it again.
Do you want to blame that on 600 people?
Well, the school district attempts to justify its punishment on the assertion that some students in the audience might have been offended by this speech. And I don't think that's a sufficient justification to prohibit speech in our society. In our society, especially in the political context, which this speech certainly was, speech which offends a few people because they choose not to hear a speech of that sort is nevertheless protected by the Constitution. That is one of the elements of our system of government, our system of democracy, that gives it its strength.
Do you think this was political speech?
It is very much a political speech.
It's a student political campaign, but it's nothing like the speech in Tinka, which really related to politics. Here, do you think the words that are particularly involved had anything to do with the political campaign?
The messages that he conveyed, the content which included sexual allusions, was part of a political speech. He was.
Yes. Are you suggesting there could be no. That the school couldn't regulate at all what one says in a political speech?
No, I'm not suggesting that. Within the school environment, speech within political speech can be regulated which is disruptive of the educational process. If any disruption which is likely to spill over into the hallways or classrooms or create personal antagonisms between students might well be prohibited.
There's some evidence of disruption here, isn't there? Some teachers.
The teachers, before they talked to their attorneys, did not claim that the speech disrupted the educational process. The trial court specifically found that there was no disruption of the educational process. Both of the judges in the majority in the Court of Appeals found that there was no disruption of the educational process, and the judge who dissented in the Court of Appeals, in his dissenting opinion, did not find any disruption shown in the record.
May I just ask you one other question, and then I'll try to keep quiet. Do you think the public schools have a duty to teach anything except reading, writing, arithmetic, history, biology, chemistry? Do you think they have any duty to teach societal values, decency in speech, moral values?
I do very much think they have duties to teach moral values, decency in speech, societal values. But teaching is best accomplished through persuasion and example, not mere punishment, which tends to produce rebellion within adolescents. And that is a more than adequate alternative in this case for teaching those community values, for achieving that state interest.
It indicates that he intentionally and knowingly used sexual innuendo in his speech. And then it goes on to say Fraser did so because he thought it would be effective to establish a rapport with his fellow students and perhaps amuse them. Whether he succeeded, this is still the judge speaking, whether he succeeded or whether he went over the line of good taste and became offensive is for his fellow students to judge when they cast their ballots in the school election. Is that really, am I reading what a judge of the federal court said?
Well, I think the federal
court. But the only test is whether it works.
Certainly, the courts should not be in a position of deciding what is in good taste and what is not in good taste, what is appropriate and what is not appropriate.
Well,
the courts should be.
This suggests that if the candidate he was supporting had been defeated, they might have had a different view. But because it worked, it is all right. Is that your view, too?
That's not my reading of the opinion. In my reading of the opinion.
I'll read it to you again. Whether he succeeded or whether he went over the line and became offensive is for his fellow students to judge when they cast their ballots.
I think,
is that your view, too?
I think that the judge is saying, and this would be my view, that the courts should not involve themselves in questions of whether the speech was inappropriate or distasteful. The question is whether the speech is protected by the First Amendment. And those who are in a position to judge whether it's distasteful or inappropriate are the students, and for that matter, the teachers and administrators who might tell the students and tell this particular student that the speech is distasteful and inappropriate, and they think that it should not be used in a political assembly. But once the students are granted the forum to exercise student politics, to say you can have an experience in American politics, but it won't be a complete experience because we're not going to give you freedom of speech. We're going to censor what you have to say and limit it. We're going to prohibit from you speech which is on a very important topic to your peers, a topic that is constantly in the minds of teenagers, really gives them an inappropriate message.
But this wasn't a speech about sex. I mean, it was about politics with sexual innuendo in the speech. Are you saying that if the school board decides that there shall be a campaign for student government and student body presidents, apparently the state of Washington requires, they can place no limits on the methods of campaigning that aren't placed on campaigning in the main political forum?
Of course, they can place the limit that the method of campaigning or the content of campaign speeches not be disruptive within the educational environment.
Oh, how about if they just say it's got to be in good taste?
No, I don't. Once they grant the students a forum for political speech, for conducting their own political exercises, they cannot tell the students that their speeches must be in good taste.
What if they say that this forum is granted to you on this condition, that you speak in good taste?
I don't think that the schools can do that. I think that once they allow
can they require students' answers in a classroom to be in good taste?
Certainly they can. That is a curricular activity.
If a student got up and made an answer in a classroom that was comparable to this, you would say that could be punished by the school?
Certainly. They could give him a bad grade. They could kick him out of the classroom. If it was a repeated problem, they could suspend him.
So the difference that you see is that this was in an organized assembly rather than a classroom.
This was in an extracurricular activity. When we're balancing the interests of
When you say extracurricular activity, no student was free to leave this assembly and go home, was he?
Well, no, but whenever students are granted a period of time to conduct extracurricular activities, they aren't free to go home. They must choose one of the extracurricular activities or go to a study hall. And that was their choice here. There was only one extracurricular activity offered, participating in student politics. But just because the state says they must offer the students an opportunity to conduct student politics doesn't mean that the students have to attend. They could all have gone to the study hall.
Is there anything in the record below that indicates what percentage of the student body turned out for this assembly?
The estimates are that almost all of the students, or virtually all of the students, did attend the assembly.
In the Senate, at least by legend, and I think accurately, drafted originally by Thomas Jefferson?
No, I'm not familiar with them.
Well, then you couldn't very well have a view as to whether or not this same speech on the floor of the Senate would be subject to censure.
No, I wouldn't venture.
Well, let's hypothetically, we've gotten into some, and you have. Suppose it did. Would you say the First Amendment would render the rule of the Senate unconstitutional if this same rule were applied and a senator were censured for making this kind of a speech on the floor of the Senate?
Well, if you would like my off-the-cuff analysis, it seems to me that once a group of people assemble together, they can adopt rules among themselves to control their own behaviors within the organization. And likewise, the students themselves could have adopted a rule which would say, within the conducts of our student politics or within our particular party, We're going to have a party assembly and meeting, and we're going to say that none of our members will be able to give speeches of this sort, or this topic is taboo. Yes, I do think they could do that as a matter of the rules of a body of an organization.
Permit the students to put a limit which the teachers and the school system could not.
If the students are voluntarily participating in an organization and that organization adopts rules for the conduct of its own meetings or activities, then yes, I think that organizations can adopt such rules.
That's a unique view of the First Amendment. We've stricken statutes adopted by legislatures sometimes because they violated the First Amendment.
Well, you're asking for my off-the-cuff analysis, mm-hmm. and I'm viewing it as an organization that is analogous to a private organization. The state has various interests in the public schools that must be balanced against the First Amendment interests within the public schools. And in the classroom, the interest tips strongly in favor of the state, because there are many sorts of speeches which, based on their content, might be disruptive of the educational process. In the extracurricular activities, it tips much more the other way. And in student politics, it tips the farthest of any of those extracurricular activities. Politics is an area where speech is accorded its highest protection. If we allow schools to tell students that they will have an experience in politics within America, and then tell them that they can be punished if they give expression which the administrators find distasteful or inappropriate, but nothing more serious than that, then we are teaching students an ugly lesson, that those in power can suppress the speech of those with whom they disagree. This is a pure speech case. This case does not involve the maintenance of discipline in the school, the control of the use of drugs, weapons, or violence. It's not a situation where the school administrators need more tools to maintain an educational environment. If the educational environment were disrupted by the speech, yes, it could be prohibited, but it wasn't. The teachers of this country believe that they have adequate tools to deal with this problem, that this is not a serious problem within the schools. When students present speech which contains sexual metaphor, no different from what they're taught in the classes, in Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet is a standard text within the classes, and there are sexual allusions and metaphor in Romeo and Juliet that are more explicit, that are actually describing sexual activity. When students are presented this in the classroom, teachers do not find that they have a problem dealing with this problem with students. I will respond to the assertion that this is a captive audience. All audiences, of course, are to a certain extent captive. But the form of expression used in this case is not unusual for high school students. This is not something that the audience who attended this assembly would have been surprised to hear. They heard a sexual reference and a four-letter word in a speech at a similar assembly 1 year earlier. Sexuality is a topic that is of great interest to teenagers. Commonly known statistics show that a great number of teenagers are in fact becoming pregnant while in high school. If we want to teach students to discuss the topic of sexuality properly, appropriately, responsibly,
this is part of the teaching process.
I'm suggesting that if the schools want to teach the students that this speech is inappropriate, they should tell that to the students. They should convene an assembly of the students and give them a presentation on why this speech is inappropriate, a presentation on what political speech in America is all about and what kind of speech in the adult world is persuasive and what is offensive. They should present that to all the students. They could present that to Matt Fraser himself. And the National Education Association has taken the position that that is a more than adequate tool for dealing with this problem, that sexual metaphor is not a serious problem in schools, unlike other discipline problems in the schools.
The NEA represents teachers, not school administrators, doesn't it?
That is correct. my opposing counsel suggests that speech can — that the local rules should be adopted by local school boards and with presumably the approval of the local parents, and that those rules ought to apply whether — no matter what the rules are. Well, the cases of Tinker and West Virginia versus Barnett show that that cannot be the law in this country, that Tinker and West Virginia versus Barnett make it clear that the Constitution does restrict the latitude of local school boards from adopting rules of that nature. Let me turn to the vagueness issue. The construction that the school board has applied in this case to the rule was made after the speech was presented. There is nothing that was done to construe this rule or give the students notice that a rule prohibiting obscene, profane language would apply to a speech which contains no profanity or no speech, no words which by themselves would cause offense.
Well, he must have been somewhat concerned about it. Don't you think, Mr. Haley, he went to some teachers and asked their judgment on it?
I do think that shows that he was concerned that it might violate a school rule, and that when he was told, when none of the teachers suggested that it might violate a school rule, and none of them took any actions to block the presentation of the speech, none of them told him not to give the speech or went to the administration and said...
Well, they came pretty close to telling him not to give the speech. If he has any sensitivity, you'd know that that is what they were saying.
The record shows that the teachers responded in the proper fashion under the First Amendment. They gave more speech to present their views of the propriety of this speech, and they indicated to him, but Matt, we will leave it up to you. If you think that this is a speech that you want to present at that political assembly, then we're not going to stop you.
They said that in so many words, you haven't read those words to us.
Well, the third teacher, whose testimony was not explicitly stated in the record of the trial court, but whose analysis of the speech was presented in a letter given to the administration, which is reprinted at the end of the...
Why did he go to the teachers at all?
Well, the record does not suggest why he went to the teachers at all in any specific manner. My understanding from working on this case from the beginning is that he went to the teachers for two reasons. One, to see whether they thought that he would get in trouble for presenting the speech, or whether this was something that that they wanted to stop. And two, because he had a relationship with these teachers of student and teacher, and he wanted to show them what he was doing. He wanted to show them how clever he was, and how artfully he had created a speech which would be very entertaining to his classmates.
You regard this as a clever speech?
I believe the record contains the analysis of the comments of some of the people who in the school, teachers or students, who did view the speech as clever. I think within the context of the adolescent mind and the kinds of things that they're interested in, they did find it very clever. My time is up.
Mr. Coates.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. By way of response, Mr. Haley did read from the record, but he didn't go on. And I did ask, when the teacher said, I told him I thought it could cause problems, I said, well, could you explain what you thought you implied? And the teacher said, well, I think by saying that could cause problems and raise eyebrows, I also realized that the speech was indeed ambiguous and could be interpreted a number of ways. So rather than debate with Matt on morality, profanity in it, I thought it might be best to just point out, or at least try to reason, that it could indeed cause problems as far as his remaining few weeks at the school. I did not know what the consequences could be. And indeed, the teacher does not administer the discipline. But when you read a fair reading of the record, when you realize this is 10 minutes before the speech, when these teachers had other students present, I think that their comments could not be construed as giving this student license to say anything he wanted to say at that assembly. I want to respond first to Justice Powell's question, is this political speech? And, Justice Powell, I'd refer you to this Court's decision in Connick versus Myers. And in that case, the Court considered speech between an assistant district attorney, or actually as a petition that an assistant district attorney circulated in the office. And she was fired as a result of that petition. And this Court, in considering that case, said that there was only one question in that petition that had any public significance, and the rest of it was just an internal communication within the office, and that this Court should not involve itself. We would suggest to you that that case applies here, that there is no big political issue being discussed. It was a crude joke. Secondly, I want to follow up on Mr. Justice Rehnquist's question about, does it make a difference if this is a classroom or an assembly? And I would suggest to you that it's not up to Mr. Frazier to determine the school district's curriculum. And indeed, what the statute says is the school district shall have an associated student body, and it's under the control and direction of the Board of Directors. Now, if the Board of Directors concludes that the best educational environment is a school assembly, that that's the proper place to inculcate values, that that's the proper place to, in fact, allow students to learn public discourse, that that does not change any of the factors which give school districts the authority to regulate the content of speech in the school setting. There is still the relationship of student to teacher. There are still other students around. Now, he tried to distinguish away the captive audience, but I would suggest to you that what he's suggesting is that in order to participate in your school activity such as this, and in your own school government, you should have to put up with this type of behavior. That's clearly not the law. Now, going to the issue of notice and this Court's concern about a disruptive conduct rule, I think, first of all, it's important you understand how these rules are adopted, and I think the record is clear, first of all, that we do distribute student codes. This is the total student code for Bethel. Mr. Frazier testified that it was available to him. Now, we can't force him to read it, but the Board of Directors sets out its rules. But this little pamphlet —
is it passed out to the students?
It's available in the school for students to take.
I know also that a $2 million portrait is also available to me if I put up $2 million for it. Was it given to the students?
Mr. Justice Marshall, I don't believe
yes or no.
That it was available to the students in the office where they could pick it up without cost and where it was available to them.
But
now, I cannot say it was passed out in class.
You had to go to the office to get it.
That you would have to go to the office to get it, is my understanding. That it was clearly available, however. We don't pass out, for example, criminal justice statutes either, that they are available. I'd suggest to you that even the argument that the teacher should somehow be able to waive even if the teacher said this speech is all right, they shouldn't be able to waive and undo the Board of Directors' own rule. Now, in looking at the rule, I'd point out that in the area of vagueness and overbreath, that outside of the criminal justice area, this Court has recognized a much broader standard. For example, in the case of Arnett versus Kennedy, this Court upheld a standard of efficiency of the service as a basis for firing an individual. In almost every labor contract throughout these United States, the standard for disciplining employees is cause or just cause. In addition, in the state of Washington, the standard for firing teachers is sufficient cause without any further elaboration. That these rules do not have to meet the same specificity requirement as criminal statute. Furthermore, it would be totally impractical. Impractical for two reasons.
What if a teacher gave this speech in an assembly like this? Could he be fired under the sufficient cause rule, do you think?
You know, I think if the teacher gave that speech at a school assembly, it would be a proper basis for disciplining that teacher. And it would be
Could he be discharged under the sufficient cause rule, do you think?
I would have some question whether it was a first offense and there was no a prior
assume
offense, whether we
assume
would
assume it's
the
first offense
district.
And he just thought it would be a bright idea and a real clever speech.
And the reason why it's difficult to me to respond yes or no is that it is a sufficient cause standard. I have no doubt there would be a basis for discipline. Now, whether we could sustain a discharge in front of an independent hearing officer, I have some question in my mind whether it's severe enough and whether the penalty fit the crime.
If the nature of the penalty makes a difference, would you suggest that perhaps in this context, maybe you could have called the student in and given him a severe lecture, but maybe not deprived him of the right to graduate? Or do you think that the penalty doesn't make any difference?
We didn't deprive him of the right to graduate.
Well, but suppose, I suppose you could have, though, couldn't you?
Yes, we could. There's no doubt, and I think there's a reasonable educational debate on what was the appropriate punishment here. Yeah. But I'd suggest to you that that's not a question that the federal court need answer, that that's something that's vested in the sound discretion of the public school administration following the procedure.
Well, then if you're right, and then you may well be, under this rule he could have been expelled from school and there'd be no constitutional objection.
I don't think there's a First Amendment issue. I think in any discipline case there's a due process issue of whether the punishment fits the crime. You'll know in the state of Washington.
But one of the elements of the crime is the fact that it is speech.
There's no question he's being punished for his speech here. And that, you know, whether or not we can regulate that speech is clearly a First Amendment issue. Now, once we're over that hurdle, and assuming this court says, yes, you can regulate this particular speech, and the issue is then what's the effective way of doing it? And you know, should it have been a two-day suspension, or should we just talk to him? Should it have been more? That seems to me to be an issue that the First Amendment does not dictate. The First Amendment was never designed to dictate curriculum or punishment in public schools. I think that is something that's clearly vested in the discretion of the school officials within the parameters of the due process rules under which we operate. And when you look at the rule and you judge its content, I think it's important to note in Washington that the rules aren't drafted by lawyers. We have a statute that requires that parents and administrators actually work on our codes and adopt them, that the legislature has adopted a policy of participation of those who have the greatest stake in the educational outcome, and to actually work on these rules and adopt them. So when you look at the word obscene, the most of the people who are drafting this have never heard of Miller, California, I would suggest, and are not aware of the standards set forth therein, and that the district's hearing officer was correct in looking at its common and ordinary meaning, which includes indecent. And so I would think that we would hope that you would look at the context of school rules, realizing that they're not drafted by attorneys for attorneys. Thank you.
The justices may be interested in seeing that booklet. Will you leave it with the clerk?
Indeed, and it's Exhibit B in the record, but I will leave it.
It is an Exhibit 2.
It's Exhibit B in the record, but I will leave a copy for the court gladly.
Very well. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.